Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Jim. Well, the border has become the favorite theater of operations for the Trump administration. You've been living there and working there on both sides of it for decades now. Can you tell us right now who's coming over the border and why?
Yeah, do my best. In thinking about this particular task this morning, it occurred to me that there are striking parallels between the so-called refugee crisis, I call it a foreign policy crisis, of 2014 in the Obama years and the 2018 in the Trump years. What I mean by that is that there was a sudden, apparently sudden influx of refugees from the three Central American countries known as the Northern Triangle of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. I have mostly done work in Honduras. I was in San Pedro Sula, one of the major sending areas from Honduras in 2016, and have had a number of clients and been an expert witness in a number of Honduran claims. So I'm going to focus on that, although I do believe the situations are parallel in Guatemala and El Salvador. I'm going to focus on a couple of clients in 2014 and then bring it up to date. I was an expert witness for two different women who were members of a PTA in Tegucigalpa in a junior high school. And Laura, I will call her, had a daughter, and Maria had a son. And they were doing their best to protect their respective son and daughter from recruitment for prostitution or for being trained to be hitmen for the street gang, the 18th Street gang, that basically controlled that particular junior high. When I say controlled, I mean the police were, two security guards at the junior high were assassinated. The local police were clearly outgunned by the local gang. And so when these two women sought to protect their children from their position on the PTA, they too were threatened with death if they didn't leave. And so they both chose to leave on their own, but later their cases were never linked, but they were aware of each other's claims. One claim, Laura's, was litigated in San Francisco before an immigration judge. The other claim of Maria was litigated in Charlotte, North Carolina. The first one won, the second one lost. Identical facts. The judge in Charlotte was completely hostile to Central American claims, couldn't believe that they could be legitimate. So why 2014? Why was it that these two women found themselves in this crisis situation in that particular year? Well, I can't say for positive sure why, but I think it goes something like this. The number, the absolute power of the street gangs in these marginalized urban area was at a tipping point by 2014 because a number of factors, many of them U.S. Sponsored and driven, had come to bear their terrible fruit. What do I mean by that? Well, there was a massive deportation from the United States of Honduran nationals, Salvadoran, Guatemalan, convicted of crimes, often deported directly from prisons. Upon arrival in Honduras, they were subjected to what was known as the mano dura policies, which meant death squads, often executing these young men, usually men, deported back from the U.S. And they were put in prisons, mass incarceration, where these persons who may not have been particularly gang-affiliated became very disciplined and radicalized by mass imprisonment. So to cut to the chase, by 2014, they had developed a very radical, very disciplined presence, and there was no match for them. Why was there no match for them? Well, the U.S., following the coup that they blessed in 2009 and the repression and corruption that it brought on, funneled its aid, and this question of aid to these countries has never been adequately addressed in the media because the aid is overwhelmingly military, the part of the aid that's supposed to go to protect people like Laura and Maria just never gets there. There is no local police. The prosecution, the criminal justice system is completely underwater. I mean, I was asked for gas money by the local police. There was one policeman for a town of 10,000. I mean, it goes on and on. So you have this complete vacuum of authority that the gangs fill. They become the government. They become a criminal insurgency that controls everything, and you cannot escape them. So if you're on their wrong side, and this often has to do with recruitment of children, teenagers, then, you know, you've got a death mark on you. So what I'm talking about here, immigration scholars will refer to as the push factors. These are factors that push people out of Honduras, in this case, to whatever, to Mexico, to anywhere, to survive, to get away from death. And the pull factors, you know, the people that have been so hostile to these Central American refugees often say they ignore the push factors. They don't want to know anything about them. They are ignorant of them. And they talk about, well, it's all pull factors. It's leniency in U.S. laws. I heard Mike Pence yesterday. He kept referring to the loopholes in the law as creating a magnet for refugees to come. And what he was really talking about was the International Convention for the Protection of Refugees and the Refugee Law of 1980. I would highly recommend it to the Trump administration that they bother to read it, because that law is what these would-be refugees are seeking to take advantage of. It is the law of the land. And Trump and Obama both did everything they could to thwart the law. How did they do that? Well, they did it by what I'll call the three D's. Deterrence. Deterrence somehow becomes the magic word for these pull factor advocates, including, you know, sadistic types like Steve Miller all the way to Obama officials in 2014. They say, well, if we deter these would-be asylum seekers by making conditions here really harsh, then they won't come at all. Well, that's never proven to be the case, because the pull factors would only come into play because of the push factors. So how do they make it even more disagreeable and more of a deterrence? Well, long-term detention or deportation. And what has Trump added to this? Well, what Trump has added to it is really a sadistic element, requiring that persons pending their asylum application wait on the Mexican side. But even beyond that, they've used the device of metering. In other words, let's say you have 1,000 people at Tijuana who want to be interviewed for asylum. And so what the Trump people have done is say, well, we can only see 50 a day. So that means that 950 are going to be, you know, waiting at the border for who knows, maybe months. And so this in turn creates the classic kind of Trumpian, a crisis that he creates, and then he later talks about heroic measures to resolve it. So the conditions in these detention facilities are just horrid. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Had a special on it on June 12th, which I recommend. It takes a strong stomach. There's solitary confinement. There's terrible food. There's children in very harsh conditions. In addition to the people caged in Mexico, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the likes of Steve Miller, anyone of his incompetence and sadistic nature would have been fired by a decent administration long ago. But he's one of the brains behind this idea of the immigrant raids to arrest 2,000 people that is ill-conceived, and if implemented will be disastrous. So that's sort of, I think, in a nutshell, where we are. It didn't happen overnight with Trump. We just had the Trump particular spin on it. But note, my brief presentation underscores the following point. The push factors have never been addressed.
Yeah, they're so powerful that Do you think the people in Honduras don't know what's going on? I mean, they've got to traverse a really hostile and long country, Mexico, in order to get here. Do you think that any, or would any reasonable person be able to think that if you're fighting for the life of your children, if the only alternatives you see are for your children to become murderers or prostitutes, what's going to stop you from trying? You know, what are they going to do? Kill you? I mean, the options of deterring people by saying conditions are bad may immiserate people, but I don't think it's going to have an effect on the push factors you describe. And by the way, are there any, you know, we used to think of people crossing the border as young men looking for work. Is that happening now at all?
Well, no, which is an overstatement, but I mean, typically the Mexican border crosser for years and years and years was a young man, and those numbers have become negative now. They're so inconsequential. What's happened in this 2014 crisis, the 2018 crisis, is you're talking about women and children, families, unaccompanied minors. You're not talking about young men. Independently of their families. No, it's changed. It's a completely different population fleeing different conditions.
So
one thing I wanted to say, though, Mike, to follow up a little bit about the Honduran people, there's a remarkable book by Dana Frank called The Long Honduran Night, where she goes into detail of the resistance to the coup and the corruption. You know, there's an article by Jake Johnston in Intercept in August of 1917 on the role the U.S. played in the coup, the 2009 coup that deposed Zelaya and ushered in this very corrupt regime that has had the full backing of the Pentagon. And it's that regime that essentially has completely distorted the possibilities of providing protection in these neighborhoods where these people are being forced to flee. It just doesn't happen because of the military distortion, where it's the military that gets all the money and they could care less about what's going on in these neighborhoods. So November 2017, there was a presidential election where Hernandez, a big buddy of John Kelly, the former chief of staff, he was elected in clearly fraudulent ways. The U.S. recognized it the next day. But the Honduran people took to the streets en masse, and they were mowed down. There were many of them that were shot point blank, and I bring all of that up because the Honduran people consistently have tried to bring back the democracy that they had, however fragile it was before the coup, and they have been very brave in doing so. So they really want to have, you know, democratic institutions respond to their needs, but basically the U.S. black-backed military is thwarted and killed them in their efforts to do so. So I mean, there are a lot of things that a different U.S. policy could address and maybe make a real difference on the push factors, but so far it just hasn't happened.
Well, why are they doing this? I've heard Honduras referred to as like a floating U.S. military base. There are so many U.S. military bases there, but don't they have any sort of agricultural economy, or do they have any manufacturing at all, or has the economy just simply dried up?
Well, the economy has certainly shrunk since the coup, and there's a couple of factors that I think are relevant here. And I recommend Jake Johnstone's Intercept article because it's really good about how again and again the sort of Pentagon and Hillary Clinton types were saying, well, you know, we have very important military assets and investments in Honduras. We have a big base there. You know, there's arms sales. There's certain interests. Yeah. We need to protect those interests. Okay, we all know about that. On the other hand, in the rural areas, you've got extraction capitalism going on with the backing of the military, where, in other words, subsistence farmers will be dispossessed of their land, so as to plant, you know, acres and acres of African palm, or in Guatemala, maybe coffee or biofuels. And if there's any resistance to that dispossession of the campesinos, then that's met with bloody repression by the same army that you and I are paying for, you know.
Well, James, we've got about a minute to go. Do you have any ideas in this bleak landscape of how we can minimize the push factors that are causing people to leave their homes where everyone would prefer to stay if it were possible and embark on the dangerous journeys that they're presently traveling?
Well, you know, I think the only hope, and Bernie Sanders and his work on the resolution about Saudi Arabia and Yemen gave me hope, that the progressive forces in the Congress will start to focus on these push factors and hold hearings about them and hold the Pentagon to task for their misdirected policies. But the only way that's going to happen is you've got to have congressional people that are willing to make foreign policy in Central America, in this case, a priority. And other than that, I'm not very pessimistic that these issues will ever be addressed. Certainly, the media has done a terrible job about even talking about them.
Yeah, there's just a gaping void as to why women, why children 6 and 8 years old would start walking 1,000 miles through hostile country. Jim, it's great to hear from you, and I thank you much, and I hope we get to talk again about this stuff.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.